Welcome to this Tuesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, Dr. Tom Easern explores how writers, historians, and government planners have tried to make sense of the Missouri River as a unified region and what is lost when our ability to see and understand places begins to fade. And we open Main Street today with Thomas Dolby. He might be known for his 80s worldwide hit, She Blinded Me with Science. You've probably heard it a time or two. But did you know he was also an innovative Silicon Valley star? He founded an interactive audio company called Beatnik, which was an early pioneer in audio technology for cell phones. And being from a family of teachers, the English musician now resides in Baltimore, where he's a professor of music at Johns Hopkins University. But school's out for the summer, so he's touring with a full band, and North Dakota is on his itinerary. Our resident Thomas Dolby fan, Eric Dethridge, has this conversation. And I can trace my history down one generation to my home in one of our submarines.
It's not too often one gets to talk with a musician that had Eddie Van Halen and Jerry Garcia guest on an album. But then again, it's not every day I speak to someone who backed up David Bowie at Live Aid, Roger Waters at the Berlin Wall, helped pioneer synth-driven pop music during the peak 80s era of MTV and way beyond, was the first musical director of the TED conferences, and he helped revolutionize the polyphonic ringtones in billions of phones. He's going to be in Newtown, North Dakota, on August the 1st, leading the Totally Tubular Festival at the Four Bears Casino. Thomas Dolby, to borrow one of your song titles, welcome to the North Dakota Airwaves.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, I have to ask you, is North Dakota the 50th state for you to check off on your 50-state bucket list? Have you been here before?
You know, I believe it is, unless I've driven through in the past, but I'm looking forward to paying you a visit.
Well, you're going to experience lots of great scenery on the way, and Newtown's right on Lake Sakakawea, so it's a beautiful vista there. I'm sure you'll quite enjoy it, but I know Thomas Dolby fans will flock far and wide to see you for the rare chance to see you play live, busy man that you are. But this is an extra special tour because instead of the really awesome shows you've been doing solo in recent years, you're getting the old band back together that starred on your third album, Aliens Ate My Buick, from 1988. Obviously, and unfortunately, it's not possible for a full reunion, but you tell me who's going to be there, the big star addition to the band, and then who sadly cannot be there.
Yeah, so I have two original founding members of the Lost Toy People, Laura Creamer on percussion and backing vocals, and Larry Treadwell on guitar. I also have filling in on bass is Divinity Rocks, who is a very distinguished bass player and singer, and she's best known probably for being the musical director at Beyoncé's backing band.
That's pretty incredible. And actually, I mean, Divinity Rocks, what a bass player. I guess she's schooled in the Victor Wooten style of sort of the hand-slapping bass, which was huge on Aliens Ate My Buick. And I mean, it's quite a funky album. Describe how the bass guitar played such a prominent role on that record.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. A lot of my songs are very bass-driven. They sort of start off with a groove, with a memorable bass line. And when I formed Lost Toy People in the late 80s, I just arrived in Los Angeles, and I was only planning to stay for a year or so, but I ended up staying for quite a few years. And I formed a local band to go out and play clubs. I was really in a mood to play some live music. And I put an ad in the Recycler magazine and got a sack full of cassettes. And among them was one from a guy called Terry Jackson, who was a phenomenal bass player, who unfortunately, a couple of years later, was one of Reba McEntire's bands who crashed a private jet, and nobody survived that. So Divinity has some very distinguished shoes to step into, and she does a terrific job. And I think when you come and see us live, you'll see just how crucial the bass parts are to my songs.
Well, Well, the tour is ongoing right now as we speak. I'm talking to you in Phoenix. So how has that been, bringing this band to life on stage and working with the band again?
Tonight's the first night. I'm absolutely thrilled. 38 years since our last performance, which was with Depeche Mode at the famous Rose Bowl 101 concert in 1988. So it's been great getting the old guys back together. You know, it's been a lot of water under the bridge, and of course they don't remember every note of the old tunes, but it's been a great vibe, and I think we're all a bit older and wiser, but still funky as hell.
Yeah, it's a very funky album. And when the album came out, being a Thomas Dolby fan that I am, I mean, it was just like in your face, kind of different in a very good way. It had everything. It had horn-driven stuff that started the album, like that Sinatra-like opener, an incredibly catchy song penned by George Clinton, kind of a definite Parliament Funkadelic mothership vibe going on. There's this little undercurrent of Prince, maybe an homage to him. I was picking up on a Zappa attitude. There's an epic piece called Budapest by Blimp. I mean, you had Robin Leach, you had Ed Asner voices on there. I mean, it was nominated for a Grammy, but I'm wondering, how did your hardcore fans take that record, because it was such a departure?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I mean, on my first two albums, there'd been a couple of sort of very outgoing songs like She Blinded Me With Science and Hyperactive, but the general sort of mode that I tended to be in was quite reflective, quite introverted. So when I moved to LA, it was like Aliens Ate My Beard was like sending a postcard back home saying, hey mom, I'm out here having a great time. My fans, you know, some of them found it a little bit on the nose, understandably, but it actually opened up a legion of other types of fans for me. I think there are some musicians to this day who say, oh, that album, man, that's the one, if you're a Dolby fan.
It's called Pulp, and it is tightening the minds of our young people today.
Yeah. One of the standout tracks on Aliens that a lot of people point to, including like sound engineers apparently, is Pulp Culture. I'm wondering why they gleaned onto that, and can you tell me what's special to you about that song?
Yeah, well, the album was co-produced by Bill Bottrell, who later became very famous for Sheryl Crow and Michael Jackson productions that he did. Bill was an amazing sound engineer, and he kind of ushered in the end of the 80s era of sort of overblown, solid-state logic-driven, you know, digital effects-heavy sound. And he loved to just sort of take a great-sounding snare drum and mic it up really well and not do anything to it. And sound engineers often ask me, oh man, how'd you get that snare sound? I go, well, we had this classic Ludwig snare. Yeah, we took it to a corner of the room. Yeah, we mic'd it up with an SM57. Yeah, and that's it. We just put it through the whole song. So there's a certain rawness about it, which I think sound engineers find is great for testing out their systems at festivals. So you quite often hear it, you know, in sound checks and things. And audiophiles, I think, when they're showing off their stereos.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Etheridge on the phone with Thomas Dolby. Thomas, every one of your records has a different sound. That's what's so attractive about your music for a lot of fans. But obviously, pianos and synthesizers are always at the forefront, at the heart of it. During your last solo tour, you opened up with an excellent cover of New Order's Blue Monday. I must have watched it 100 times. It's terrific. Why do you think synth-powered music is still so popular and catching on with new generations?
I think the synthesizer is a blank canvas. As the name would suggest, you can use it to simulate the sound of, you know, physical instruments. But it can also be very abstract. And I think in recent years, you know, a lot of musicians have grown up with software synthesizers, you know, using their computers, and they will dig right into the weeds of the software synthesizer and get sounds out of it that don't really replicate anything that we're used to from the physical world. So it's a fascinating instrument for exploration. I think in my case, whereas many of my contemporaries leaned into the inherent sort of coldness and mechanical nature of synths, like, you know, Kraftwerk and Hewan League and Gary Newman and people like that. But I was always into the more sort of the softer human side, really. And so I created these very atmospheric soundscapes with the synths. And my approach to arrangement is quite orchestral. And I've only realized now, really, now that I'm spending so much time around symphony orchestras as a professor at Peabody Conservatory, that I realized that all along I was really just a frustrated orchestral composer.
Thomas, your musical accomplishments, they're long and many. I should mention you are the person, for those that don't know a lot about Thomas's music, but then know this song, Waiting for a Girl Like You. That's your synthesizers that drive that song, the one of their biggest hits. You produced Joni Mitchell and George Clinton. But I think one of your biggest achievements was helming two timeless records. Talk about orchestration. I mean, you were the genius behind the pop genius band Prefab Sprout. There are two albums of theirs, Steve McQueen and Jordan to Come Back. Big ones for me in my collection, too. And if you don't know the band, and there are probably many that unfortunately do not, can you tell us about Prefab Sprout, Thomas, and the frontman Patty McAloon, and how you look back on those records today?
You know, Prefab Sprout was a band formed by two brothers, Paddy and Martin McAloon, up in the northeast of England, sort of close to Newcastle. They had a band since a very early age, and Paddy, who actually went to a seminary and I think was destined for the cloth, but sort of rebelled against that and became a songwriter, and very early on was compared to people like Steely Dan. Very sophisticated pop music with lots of complicated chord sequences and so on. One dance, whose steps I never could learn. It's called the Wedding March. I actually met them because I heard, I was a guest reviewer on Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, in the UK, and I really detested most of the records I had to review, except this one from Prefab Sprout. So I said very nice things about it. And the band were listening at the time, and they approached me and said, you know, would I consider working with them on an album? And that turned into a decade-long relationship. I did 2.5 albums with them. And Steve McQueen in particular, but also Jordan the Comeback, which was at the end of the 80s, are considered, you know, in the UK, some of the best albums, you know, ever. Certainly some of the best to come out of that decade. And Paddy now, unfortunately, is not well. He has serious health problems, hearing problems, and eyesight problems. But he still lives out in the hills outside Newcastle and has a long white beard.
Yeah, sort of Gandalf-like, right? Yeah,
he has a white linen suit and a stick with an emerald handle. and he's occasionally spotted in the hills around there, sort of like the Yeti, but considered a national treasure in the UK.
He is, and his brother, you know, the music lives on through his brother, Martin. Martin's playing shows, and I know he's opened some shows and played with you. I think you guys did Bonnie not too long ago, right?
We did, yeah. I mean, we played Bonnie together. He's open for a bunch of shows for me in the UK. And Martin is great. He's sort of like a stand-up comedian whose particular gimmick is that he used to be in a top pop group years ago, and his brother is a genius national treasure. So, I mean, it's great to have had that relationship, and I really care about those albums, you know, almost as much as my own. So I think if you've never heard of Prefab Sprout, you should get their album, which is called Two Wheels Good in the USA.
That's right, because of a dispute with the Steve McQueen estate, it's called Two Wheels Good here in the US. And then Jordan to Come Back, you'll hear Thomas Dolby on it. I mean, your signature is there. We hear it. But what I love about it is you really just let the music and Patty and the band flourish, and the production is crisp, like you said, almost Steely Dan-like in its sonic crystalline crispness, and it's just, those are two wonderful time capsule records. All I stole and I took from you, but Barley don't live at home.
Barley don't live at home. Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment. I think the thing about production is that when the arrangement is good, your job is half done already. So I spent a lot of time with the band just sort of working through the arrangements in the rehearsal room before we ever went into the studio.
Well, you alluded to this earlier, Thomas, but I should probably call you Professor Dolby. You are a teacher in my hometown of Baltimore, Maryland, at Johns Hopkins University's Peabody Institute. Tell us exactly what you're teaching and what wisdom you are imparting for these young students of yours.
Yeah, so I teach film music composition, and I have some great students, some of whom are classically trained. You know, they've been playing an instrument all their lives. And some of them really grew up in the computer era, and I discovered them, you know, because they were putting stuff up on SoundCloud or YouTube that they'd done, you know, in their back room. But we teach them to write film and video game music. And a lot of it really is you know, these are client-based businesses. You have a boss, the film director, the showrunner, the game developer. And so you can't go into it thinking that you're going to create your masterpiece and you know, get it shown on TV. To become John Williams or Hans Zimmer is something that takes decades and years, and you have to sort of work your way up the ladder. So many of them, you know, that graduated from my course are now working in Hollywood as assistants to other composers, or doing sort of associated jobs like, you know, tech support or sort of musical transcriptions and orchestrations and things like that to the film music industry. And yeah, I mean, I try and bring them the benefit of my experience. I wish that I knew when I was their age what I know now.
Are you a tough teacher, tough grader?
Well, you know, I'm tougher on them than I was on myself back in the day. I mean, you know, you are part of a team when you're working on a film. You're one of those names that scrolls by in the credits. And you are responsible and accountable to everybody else, whether it's wardrobe, lighting, cameraman, you know, electrician. Everybody has to combine to produce this sort of sense of, you know, that suspension of disbelief that is a film. And of course, the music is a crucial part of it. But yeah, you have to fall in with all of that. So, I mean, I'm very tough with them. If they assign the wrong file name, you know, to a file, or they bounce down a track and they forgot to take the metronome click out, yeah, I'll dock them a lot of points.
Well, I'm wondering too, like, you know, you're thinking about academia these days, and you can't help but think of how AI creeps into the conversation. But musically, I imagine that's a topic of conversation. What are, you know, you've always been comfortable embracing and utilizing and pioneering technology. How do you see the future of music with AI?
You know, I mean, a lot of my students are very against it, understandably, not only for the obvious reasons like cutting down the rainforest and using all this water and immense amounts of power, and the same set of billionaires own the AI companies as they seem to own everything else. Those are all very logical concerns. I've always been a guy that is like glasses half full, and I see incredible creative possibilities with AI. Really, as a better way for humans to interface with computers. I mean, you know, for years I worked on my laptop with a sort of graphic representation of an analog recording studio with knobs and faders and dials and patch cords and things like that. But the thing is, I'm not a studio sound engineer. With AI, I say, oh, can you make this sound a little bit brighter? And it says like this. And I go, oh, maybe not brighter, maybe more shimmery. And it goes, how about this? And I go, yes, that's exactly what I need. Would you like me to try that on the guitar parts as well? Yeah, let's try that. You know, so it's more like a collaboration, you know, and it is more creative and sort of right brain way to work than you know, just working with a sort of graphic reduction of the real world.
Yeah, and it seems to be, you know, there are possibilities of pushing music forward rather than just, you know, pure replication.
Yeah. I'm obviously with a lot of pitfalls, but I mean, I think whenever there's a big technological advance, there's been, you know, everybody's saying the sky is falling.
Right.
But it's going to lead to a new era of music, and won't necessarily be better. It's going to be different, and different is good because I think pop music has to keep evolving.
Indeed, the Totally Tubular Festival is at the Four Bears Casino in Newtown, North Dakota. It's happening Saturday, August 1st. Thomas Dolby and the Lost Toy People full band, they're going to be headlining. Also there, A Flock of Seagulls, Bow Wow Wow, The Producers, Animotion, The Escape Club. And yes, the band with the most famous phone number in the world, Tommy Two Tone. Now you can find info on tickets at thomasdolby.com or Four Bears Casino, that's with the number 4.com. There's ticket, hotel, bus packages from Bismarck and Williston, things like that. Thomas, what is it like touring with all these bands that kind of came out or came to life at the same time that you did?
There's a lot of love, actually. You know, it's like when we were in our 20s, we were all a bit frosty to each other, a bit competitive, you know, the British wave, and we were sort of keen to hog the limelight. You know, you get to our age And backstage, it's kind of a riot, actually, you know, because people have their husbands and wives and girlfriends and boyfriends and, you know, their nannies and kids and personal trainers. But it's very warm-hearted and chummy, and nobody's going to stay up all night, you know, in the hotel bar, because we've got to be up at 7 a.m. to meet with your Pilates instructor.
Now, I mentioned in the beginning that the album that featured Eddie Van Halen and Jerry Garcia soloing on separate songs, that album was called Astronauts and Heretics. The song that opens that record is truly a special one for not only me, but we play it a lot here at Prairie Public. It's called I Love You, Goodbye. It features Cajun stars Beau Soleil, one of my favorite piano solos from you, and a line about a dirty Datsun, which literally was my first car. Can you share any insight into that song? Was this Cajun tale autobiographical?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of my songs, you know, sort of based on real life experiences, but then I elaborate and fictionalize them. You know, a good friend of mine in Los Angeles moved very suddenly to New Orleans, and I was very sad to see him go. But I went down there with him and sort of got an inside view of New Orleans and out in the bayou, the whole sort of Cajun scene there. And I was really enchanted with it and had this sort of great experience there. And I, you know, I wrote this song about that experience. Got me in a lot of trouble, though, because when I'm writing lyrics, if it scans and it rhymes, then I don't often do a lot of research as to the verification of it. Mm. So, I mean, I got in a lot of trouble because, you know, I talk about the Everglades and forgot that the Everglades are in Florida, not in Louisiana. And I talk about a county sheriff, but, of course, they have parishes down there, not counties.
Oh, yeah.
And Datsuns haven't existed for a number of years. I mean, it was a dirty old Datsun, but of course they changed their name to Nissan. So, but they seem to love it down there anyway. They call it the Bayou Rain Song. It was very popular in Baton Rouge on the radio.
Oh, I bet. It's just one of many songs that just have stuck with me all my life, pretty much, in your vast collection of stuff. And it's not only music, it's not only technology. Speaking of autobiographical books, you've penned one that is about yourself and your life, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. And there's a historical fiction novel of Prevailing Wind that was out in 2024. That's about yachting, going back to, I think, the World War I, World War II era. But I know you like to do some sailing. Being in Baltimore now, do you ever get a chance to get out on the Chesapeake Bay?
Switch on!
I do, yeah. I love sailing on the Chesapeake Bay. It's a great sailing area. And Annapolis is a real global hub for professional yachtsmen from the America's Cup and LGP and stuff like that. And actually, right on Baltimore Harbor, I can see out my window. I can see people sailing, and there's a little sailing club that sort of meet there, and I go sailing. I can see that from my deck. So, yeah, it's really the way that I, you know, sort of chill out. When I'm out there doing it, just using nothing but the wind to propel me, it's like I can't possibly think about all those knobs and faders.
Maybe not the production stuff, but does that influence or inspire any of your songwriting when you're writing lyrics when you're sailing?
I think the mood definitely seeps in, and I'm constantly processing, you know, new songs, so I have them going around my head. A lot of my stuff I write pretty much in my imagination, you know, when I'm sailing, when I'm out for a walk, when I'm you know, doing the laundry, and then when I get in front of a keyboard, that's when I figure out what was in my imagination.
Well, if you could just imagine, put your imagination caps on, Thomas Dolby and his full band at Four Bears Casino, August the 1st, and you're playing Aliens Ate My Buick, Thomas, pretty much start to finish, maybe save for one song, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't make sense in the time that we have to play Budapest by Blimp, which is 8.5 minutes long, but the rest of the album we will play, and we'll do our best to reproduce it and add a few tweaks. I hope people come and see us, and it'd be cool to see us in a casino setting.
Tell me about your childhood.
Well, it's very exciting that you are coming to North Dakota Thomas Dolby. We couldn't be more excited. I thank you so much for joining us on Prairie Public. It's a real thrill.
All right. I look forward to seeing you.
I was hooked to a machine just to keep my mouth from spouting junk. Ha! Must have took me for a fool, cause they chucked me out of school, cause the teacher knew I had the fun. But tonight I'm on the edge, you better shut me in the fridge, cause I'm burning up. I'm burning up. With the vision in my brain and the music in my veins,
that's Eric Deathridge talking to one of his musical heroes, Thomas Dolby, who, along with his band, The Lost Toy People, will headline the Totally Tubular Festival in Newtown, North Dakota, on Saturday, August 1st. Still to come on Main Street, seeing the Missouri River as place and soaring health insurance costs squeeze farmers. That's all still ahead on this Tuesday, and it follows this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Glad you are with us on this Tuesday. The Missouri is America's longest river, but can it be understood as one place with a shared history and identity? Here's historian Dr. Tom Eason from North Dakota State University with his Plainsfolk essay.
In my mail appears a thoughtful gift, a book, inscribed to me by one of the authors. The Missouri, America's Longest River, edited by John K. Lauck and published by the Center for Western Studies, Augustana University. The chapters are various, from native forests to Indian-white conflict to big dams and their consequences, so let me focus on some pieces, then try to say something about the whole, if that's possible, because the more you read, the more you become conscious of our failure to comprehend, historically, the Missouri River as a whole. John Lauck makes a noble effort in the introduction, which is a road trip. Lauck begins at the beginning, the Three Forks in Montana, and weaves his way physically downriver to the end at St. Louis. He's looking for something, for the hope of a larger whole, and his narrative is chock full with local color, but before the end, after listening long to the river, trying to hear its faint or fading regionalist voices, he says. He despairs and declaims, "Our ability to see places is slipping. Taking I-29 down past Sioux City is a vortex of placelessness." And he despairs that the Kansas City Art Museum appears to have forgotten who Thomas Hart Benton was. Well, 'twas not always so. The volume in the landmark Rivers of America series, devoted to the Missouri, a book published in 1945, carries the author credit of Stanley Vestal, which was the pen name for Walter Campbell. Campbell taught nonfiction writing at the University of Oklahoma for a full generation. He was one of the few literary or academic lights not from the Northern Plains who actually knew something about the region. He had published his acclaimed biography of Sitting Bull in 1932. Campbell was a titan in the tribe of writers devoted to literary nonfiction, that is, the writing of true and significant works that carry authority, but not footnotes. His was the most salient volume in the Rivers of America series. Campbell was a Westerner. When he traveled to Oxford for his Rhodes Scholarship in 1908, he packed a six-shooter in his bag. He declared the story of the Missouri River to be an heroic poem, an epic. In the chapter about Campbell and his book, written for the Current anthology, Robert Dorman notices that Campbell approaches the Missouri and finds his epic from east to west. It makes you wonder if John Lauck's view might have been more cheery if he had done the same. Now, while Campbell was making the Missouri a warm line in literature, making a place of it, it proved impossible to sell that sense of it in the political arena. At the close of the Second World War, government planners wanted to do in the Missouri River Valley what they had done with the Tennessee River Authority, make of it a prosperous, developing region, federally created, focused on public power generation. The Corps of Engineers told this story assiduously. The Missouri River unites us. Let's get together for the common good. The region exists. Let's give it a name and a reality. Now, that was not as cynical as it may sound. As Bryce Tellman, who discusses this development in the new book, points out, although they cannot be invented out of nothing, nevertheless, he says, regions, to put it bluntly, are made up. In this case, it didn't stick. The states of the would-be region, and in particular their governors, had their own interests. So instead of the lofty Missouri Valley Authority, we got the patchwork Pick Sloan plan. Dr. Carol Butcher was the friend who sent me the thick new collection on America's longest river. She wrote a fine chapter about the legendary steamboat captain, Grant Marsh, who they said could pilot a steamboat over a heavy dew. She reminds me that I need to visit Captain Grant's grave in St. Mary's Cemetery of Bismarck and give a listen.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he writes and presents Plains Folk.
FM Kicks Band presents Jazz Night Saturday, August 1st from 5 to 9 p.m. at 4 and 4 above Side Street. The Jazz Festival follows Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 5 p.m. at Gooseberry Park. Community members of all ages are welcome. Information at fmkicksband.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Farmers are already contending with soaring fuel, fertilizer, and equipment costs. Now many are facing another financial strain as health insurance premiums sharply rise. Harvest Public Media's Macy Byers reports.
Ben Steffen is driving past fields of corn and soybeans on his farm in southeastern Nebraska.
The crop's growing fast and the weeds are growing faster.
Yeah.
We pull up to a barn that's full of hay. It used to hold dairy cattle, but Steffen sold them a few years ago. Now he's focused on crops, but costs have been high this year as the war with Iran pushed up fertilizer and diesel prices.
I mean, this is the most expensive crop we've ever put in the ground. And it's kind of breathtaking when you do this year after year and you keep seeing those numbers go up.
On top of those high input costs for farming, Steffen and his wife, Paula Sue, are also dealing with higher costs for health care. They used to be part of a group health plan when they had employees handling the dairy operation. Since then, they've switched to an Affordable Care Act plan, or Obamacare.
Last year, we paid around $13,000 net after we got our premium credit back.
That was for the two of us. That was our out-of-pocket expense.
Yeah. And this year, we're on track to pay $32,000 a year.
$32,000. That's about $2,700 a month, more than double what they were paying the year before. And that's one of the cheapest options. ACA plans are a common choice for people who can't access health care through a traditional employer, like farmers and ranchers. Congress allowed tax credits to expire this year that covered some of the health plan's costs. Now, premiums have doubled or even tripled for many users.
It's scary because it's cutting into their bottom line. They didn't necessarily budget for this. They didn't plan for this.
That's Nick Lewandowski, who leads the Kansas Farmers Union.
And so therefore, they've got to make difficult decisions around that. You know, I have heard of people who've just flat out dropped their insurance.
Lewandowski, who also farms, says his own ACA premiums nearly tripled this year. Some lower-cost health options for farmers are offered through farm bureaus and unions, but the plans are limited. Many farm families have a spouse work off the farm to get health insurance. Dina Vanderzalm works with the Missouri Rural Crisis Center. She says the organization advocated for the Affordable Care Act because it kept family members on the farm and helped farmers address medical issues earlier.
Having access to insurance is super duper important for the farming community because that's protecting them from letting massive medical debt sink the farm, right? It's a layer of protection.
The Missouri Rural Crisis Center and other groups are calling on Congress to bring back the ACA tax credits. In the meantime, Vanderzalm says farmers are dealing with razor-thin margins.
It is a constant juggle. You know, we're still hearing from people of, like, we're making choices on bills, we're paying minimums on things, we're setting up payment plans with doctor's offices, not just hospitals.
She says farmers are used to unpredictable factors, like weather or how their harvest will turn out. But now it's a given that their health plan will be expensive. Even though the business is tough now, Ben and Paula Sue Steffen say they still wouldn't choose any other profession.
The freedom to be in, you know, self-employed is undervalued and underappreciated. Our corn's growing 3 or 4 inches every day, it seems like, and you can just see the landscape changing. It's a hopeful season. It's a hopeful business, really.
And the 64-year-olds hope this will be their last year with high health costs as they plan to enroll in Medicare next year. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Macy Byers.
That reporting is from Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms covering agriculture, food systems, and rural issues.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2026 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
The oceans are running out of oxygen. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Earth's oceans, lakes, rivers, and streams contain dissolved oxygen, which comes from the atmosphere and plants. All aquatic animals need dissolved oxygen to breathe.
Now, scientists warn these waters are rapidly losing oxygen, which could push the planet to be a, quote, unsafe space.
Researchers led by Scripps Institution of Oceanography say the loss of oxygen is driven primarily by human-caused warming, nutrient pollution, and changes in the ventilation of interior waters.
The warmer water is, the less dissolved oxygen it can hold. And the less it circulates, the less oxygen-rich surface waters mix with deeper regions.
The loss could be irreversible and will make our planet unstable and less resilient, the scientists say.
It threatens life from the top to the bottom of the food chain, from microscopic organisms to sharks, and even marine mammals that breathe oxygen from surface air, like whales, that are affected because the loss of oxygen impacts their prey and ecosystems.
The new study is an effort to show how aquatic oxygen loss should be considered a major threat to life on Earth, along with ocean acidification, biodiversity loss, chemical pollution, and climate change.
The federal government has decided to cut the amount of water that California, Nevada, and Arizona will be allowed to draw from the Colorado River to address, at least in the short term, the crisis in the Southwest.
Climate change and drought are reducing flows in the Colorado River Basin, resulting in a huge gap between the water supply and the demand by farms, cities, and industry.
The largest cut will be to Arizona, which will lose 31%, according to sources who spoke to the Los Angeles Times. Nevada would see its share drop by 28%, and California by 12% through 2028.
The plan is consistent with what the three states offered earlier this year to reduce their combined withdrawals from the river by more than 3 million acre feet.
Those lower basin states could have lost more. Earlier this year, the Bureau of Reclamation released a draft impact statement that could have cut Arizona's supply by 77% and perhaps even higher by 98%.
According to the Times, the federal government will not impose cuts to the allocations of the four upper basin states of Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, and Colorado for now.
Donald Trump has made no secret of the fact that he doesn't like offshore wind. He's done everything in his power, so to speak, to stop the developments, which he calls ugly, by having his administration deem them to be national security risks.
But you'd be wrong to assume Trump doesn't like offshore development, period. His Interior Department has moved to open federal waters to other industrial activities, including offshore spaceports and deep-sea mining.
Now, his administration has announced it wants to put nuclear power projects in the ocean. Last week, the Marine Minerals Administration and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission signed a memorandum of understanding that establishes a framework for how they would evaluate future developments on the outer continental shelf of the U.S.
To be clear, the MOU does not authorize nuclear development in the ocean. The goal is to be ready because Trump aims to quadruple U.S. nuclear power capacity by 2050, in part to meet power demands of data centers.
And finally, the ocean is a naturally noisy place. Icebergs calve, marine life clicks and calls, and waves crash.
But humans have added to the din with sounds of military sonar, shipping, and drilling, and that's making it harder for ocean creatures to communicate.
One such group are sperm whales. They converse through energetic and rhythmic clicks called codas to maintain social bonds and coordinate activity.
But new research from Project SETI, a nonprofit studying sperm whale communication, suggests shipping noise is changing the messages sperm whales are sending and may even be altering what they receive.
Think of it as how you would talk to a friend at a super noisy party. Not only would you have to talk louder, but you might also limit your exchange to the essentials instead of having an in-depth conversation.
David Gruber, founder and CEO of Project SETI, who co-authored the new study, thinks this may be what's happening among sperm whales.
His team analyzed more than 1,000 vocalizations recorded from 15 whales over 4 years in the Eastern Caribbean and found that when ship noise was present, the whales both shortened and switched the codas they use.
Furthermore, National Geographic reports that SETI scientists have identified two vowel-like codas in sperm whale communication. Longer A codas that resemble our A's and shorter I codas analogous to how we say I. The team found that when there was shipping noise, the whales switched to A codas.
The question is whether the whales are talking about the ships or adapting to their presence so they can be heard. We don't yet know, but the finding shows that noise pollution is causing animals to change their tune, which could send a loud and clear message to humans to put a sock in it.
Like what you hear on This Week in Water? We are a nonprofit organization and you can support our work at h2oradio.org. And thank you.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
If you walk through the prairies and woodlands frequently, or perhaps even your own backyard, you may come upon a rather delicate, whitish, translucent tube of thin material, several inches long, that has a scale pattern that resembles the skin of a snake. Well, it probably is a snake skin. It might come as a surprise, but snakes do occasionally shed their skin. The skin of a snake is composed of several layers, and the outermost layer is composed of overlapping scales that are largely composed of keratin, the same material in fingernails and toenails. It's this outer layer that snakes must occasionally shed. This outer skin layer of a snake does not grow along with the growth of the snake. And of course, it's a subject to wear and tear. It may also carry parasites and other harmful organisms. So the outer layer must be shed occasionally to accommodate growth and maintain fully functional skin. Although the frequency of a snake shedding its skin is quite variable, a ballpark estimate would be in the range of 4 to 6 weeks or so, depending on growth rates, nutrition, and other factors. As one might expect, good vision is important to a snake. But snakes do not have eyelids like humans. Instead, what they have are called eye caps, a thin layer of skin that covers the eye. That layer is also shed. And if it's not shed properly, vision may be permanently impaired or perhaps the snake become blind. Visible changes occur in the snake when it's about to shed its skin. The skin becomes dull or faded, and the eyes turn cloudy or blue-colored. The snake also becomes less active and spends more time in hiding. After a few days, when the new skin is formed, the eyes clear up and the skin around the nose loosens. The snake will then need to rub on something to loosen the skin around the mouth. As it continues to crawl, the old skin is shed, inside out, in a fashion similar to ripping off a stocking gripped from the top. Several videos of snakes shedding their skin may be observed on YouTube. I've also put links to more information on snake skin and the shedding of the skin along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 28th. Modern-day people don't know much about oxen, unless they refer to someone as a big ox or being strong as an ox. Some might know about Red River ox carts or maybe Babe the Blue Ox's statue in Bemidji. However, oxen were useful for farmers in North Dakota's early days as draft animals, pulling stumps, loads of hay, and the heavy work of breaking new farmland with heavy plows. Although oxen were powerful and sure-footed, they were slow when compared to horses. Nevertheless, new settlers in Dakota often used oxen rather than horses because they were half the price of a good horse. Moreover, oxen were cheaper to feed, eating only grass or hay, while horses also required oats. Plainly speaking, an ox was a steer, male calves castrated to make them tamer than a bull. Farmers trained young oxen early, just 6 months old, in order to get them accustomed to the work. This gentle training began by fastening two of them together with a small neck yoke. By pulling a cart, they learned to work as a team. Ox trainers used a stick to tap an ox on the neck to teach it to turn, along with the voice commands of G and haw. G meant turn right, haw meant turn left. When the oxen were full grown, a larger and stronger yoke was used, generally made of oak. Even without reins or mouthbits, an experienced farmer's oxen would go forward or back up by the farmer's gestures or stick waving or his well-timed grunt. If those communications failed, a light whip or ox goad, a club, brought obedience. If poverty brought tough times, the farmer could survive by fattening oxen into excellent beef. On this date in 1921, the Grand Forks Herald looked back nostalgically upon the decades when faithful oxen had plowed much of the sod of the Red River Valley. By the 1920s, horses had made oxen obsolete, being better suited for all-around farm work due to greater speed and the ability to pull newer farm machinery. Oxen had been turned out to pasture, so to speak, and were rarely seen. Still, there had been a time when oxen did the heavy pulling of the farm and did it well, receiving no coddling, no currying, and no grain rations. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
American political leaders and global leaders are paying their respects to the late Senator Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey was a towering figure here in the Senate and on the international stage.
Plus, President Trump meets with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, a piece of paradise, gardening undercover near Regent, North Dakota. We'll visit with Shanae Witte, and we'll also have another edition of Prairie Plates tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.